Welcome to the ESRI and the Science of Wear podcast. The largest humanitarian demining organization in the world, the HALO Trust, has a larger goal: sustainable development. They work in about 30 countries, and 98% of their staff come from local communities. That deliberate recruitment strategy sees those staff working towards rebuilding, starting new businesses, and creating a legacy of lasting change in their communities, says HALO Trust CEO James Cowan. And in many other countries devastated by war, that means women are at the forefront of that change.
We don't just want women to be deminers, we want them to be leaders and role models to the other younger women who come in their wake. They get status, they've learned how to lead, and of course the other thing we're doing is teaching a lot of these women technical skills.
James Cowan describes to ESRI's John Lenihan how HALO Trust helps communities thrive long after the land has been cleared of danger.
Hello, James, and welcome to ESRI and the Science of Wear podcast.
John, thank you very much.
As the world's largest international explosives removal nonprofit, your funding and staffing has grown in response to the problem over the past decade. Can we set up the extent of that problem? Half of the world has buried landmines, arms, and bombs. Can you elaborate on how you determine the affected areas and how do people understand the problem?
Yeah, I think it's such an important question because we're seeing conflicts on the rise again. It reached an all-time low actually in 2005, but sadly, events since then have begun to show that conflict is returning. What I think marks landmines out from other weapons of war is that most weapons kill in the moment, but landmines stay in the ground and long after the point at which they were buried to kill or maim a soldier, they kill or maim a civilian, maybe decades after the event, because they're hermetically sealed and the water doesn't get in, nothing happens to them, they remain lethal a long time later.
Can you expand on how does HALO Trust help? What was the initial focus of HALO Trust and how did you go about the execution?
HALO was founded by a guy who'd fought in the Second World War. He'd seen his comrades killed in Northern Italy. He'd fought in the Korean War, and he saw more of his comrades killed there, again by landmines. So he had a real passion for dealing with this threat. And so he set up the HALO Trust in 1988 in Afghanistan. And it came in response to the use of landmines by the Soviets during the 10-year war in which the Soviet Union was present. The HALO Trust tackles all forms of explosive ordnance because it is those methods of waging war that are killing and maiming innocent civilians. But landmines are also, the reason why they're used is they're very efficient. If you don't have enough soldiers, you can substitute manpower for mine power. And particularly in a conflict like Ukraine with a very long front line, it's possible to defend along a very long front with fewer troops and more landmines. So that is why they're being used. But as I say, the evil lies in their longevity, and they will be there for a long time to come.
You hit on something that I as I was doing some of my research for this discussion, James, that the phases of demining. Can you expand on those and make sure the audience kind of understands those very clearly?
Yes. The first thing to say is that landmines are largely invisible for the simple reason that they're buried underground. They're not always. Sometimes they're surface laid. So the first thing you've got to do is to do what we call a broad order survey. And we do it at the sort of national level. We're always very keen to make sure we work with the national authorities of the country who is hosting us. And then we can get that what we call non-technical survey done to establish the extent of the problem. And it may be that there are several thousand minefields in a country, and we will have a broad sense of the level of contamination. And that's called suspect contamination. But what is suspect and what is actual is often very different. And at the moment, let's take an example, in Ukraine, there's a view that perhaps as much as a third of the country is contaminated. I think that will turn out from our experience to be very exaggerated. And that's very helpful because what we don't want to be doing is spending money and time and risking lives to clear land that isn't actually contaminated. So what we go from the suspect contamination to the actual contamination is the next stage, in which we do detailed technical survey to really try and reduce the size of the problem as much as we can. And it may be, we usually find it's probably about 10% of the original suspect area. And that can save, in the context of Ukraine, where the current bill is set at about 38 billion, you can imagine that if we get that down by 90%, that is a huge amount of money saved. So that's the next stage. The next stage after that is clearance, where we begin the work of actually clearing the mines. And this is, there are a number of different ways we can do it. We can do it in the old fashioned way with human deminers on their hands and knees, painstaking work. And often that is the most appropriate, but increasingly we're trying to use mechanical means to conduct the clearance to speed the process up. And that's actually, Ukraine is particularly suited to that because it's got open farmland. There are places that are mountainous or jungle that where mechanical means aren't that useful. And then finally, the final bit is making sure that we're not just getting the mine out of the ground for good in the sense of forever, we're getting the mine out of the ground for good in the sense of what follows. And we want to see sustainable livelihoods, we want to see farming, we want to see shops, we want to see human habitation. We want to make sure that land returns to its vibrant natural self.
I've been thinking over the past 10 years about the conflicts and just thinking through those, and so many of them being urban, and the difference between people going back to living in those communities and living in those areas versus rural. It must be very challenging.
It is, because most rural communities they're less densely populated and they're more stable. And one of the things that we were able to do is to go into rural communities, talk to them about where the landmine contamination was, and we could get a pretty good idea from them as to where the problem was so that we could clear it. But in an urban environment where you're dealing with very dense populations and possibly the wholesale movement of the population, you're dealing with a three-dimensional problem: below ground in tunnels, above ground in high-rise buildings, you're dealing with rubbleized buildings, and you're dealing with the population that may not be there, so may not know where the contamination is. So we've got to find a new way, whereas we could talk to human communities in the past, we've got to find new technological ways of doing that. And that's in large part where ESRI comes in.
You mentioned you've gone from demining to doing more humanitarian work. Can you explain that transition and how that evolved?
I don't see it really as a transition. It seems to me we've always done this. Our model is that we employ local people. We employ local people for a number of reasons. Firstly, because we empower them and we give them a chance to become kind of masters and mistresses of their own future. And if they can clear that land, then they can feel a sense of pride, they can turn it to farming use, and they can have a future that is safe from the effects of landmines. We're not simply interested in turning up, clearing a piece of land and then walking away. We've always wanted to make sure that the humans who live there can have a sustainable livelihood. So let me give you an example. We worked in Afghanistan in Herat province. And Afghanistan is potentially a very fertile country, but it can't be fertile unless its irrigation system is working properly. Now, there's a huge area in the west of Afghanistan, in Herat, which essentially had been contaminated by landmines, where all the canals and ditches had been deliberately contaminated. And so the whole irrigation system in this particular area had ceased to function. By clearing those canals and ditches, we restored the irrigation system, and we were able to put 50,000 people back on the land. And it's about then your conflict sensitivity, being careful to ensure that the right people take back the land in a country where often the legal record is patchy, to say the least. We've got to make sure that we're not setting up new conflict by restoring land that then people argue and, in the worst case, actually fight over. So we're very careful to make sure that the handoff is as good as it can be. Another example might be in Angola, where we're working with the Angolan government to protect the headwaters of the what's called the Angolan Water Tower. Now, this water tower feeds down into Botswana, to the Okavango Delta, and into Zambia and Zimbabwe, to the Zambezi River system. And those river systems can't operate without the Angolan water tower. We're working with various conservation organizations there to make sure that, again, we're doing this in a highly sensitive and proper way to ensure the longevity of the Angolan water tower.
James, the author writing about your work in the book, The Geography of Hope, was struck with how important women are in your organization, in Halo Trust. Can you tell us how and why that happened?
The humanitarian mine action movement, to some extent, came out of that military experience. I gave you the example of our founder, Colin Mitchell, who'd fought in the war. Because it had that military angle to it, it was naturally very male orientated. And myself, I was a general. When I took over Halo, it struck me that why shouldn't women be just as involved? And wouldn't it be a very powerful thing to start recruiting women to perhaps as much as 50% of our workforce? In many countries where we operate, actually women are fantastic deminers, and it's perfectly culturally appropriate for them to be working in this role. So let's take Sri Lanka. We've increased our workforce there to 1,200 people, and half of them are women. The same is true in Cambodia and Laos. And of course, when the war began in Ukraine, a lot of the men simply weren't available because they were either in the army or about to be conscripted into the army. So we found it incredibly powerful to recruit women. I could say the same thing for Angola, where again, we've grown hugely. We've got 1,500 staff there, and again, half of them are women. But giving women jobs, you potentially have a disproportionate effect on their life chances. A single woman with no plot of land to farm, if she's been widowed or abandoned by her husband, is facing an extremely perilous future. So what we're doing is not only giving them jobs as deminers and allowing them to feed their children, but we're potentially giving them a subsequent livelihood with that plot of land. And we're finding this is incredibly powerful. And these are very fantastic role models for women worldwide. What more powerful thing can you think of than being trained to clear landmines and then performing that role and clearing land that is then free, decontaminated, and safe for women and children and men to walk on? It's a wonderful thing to see. And some of these women now are rising up through the ranks. We don't just want women to be deminers, we want them to be leaders and role models to the other younger women who come in their wake. So I'm really excited by this and want to do a lot more to recruit more women.
And it probably does a lot to opening up opportunities for these women in the communities after the demining exercises as well.
Absolutely. Because if they've managed to save some money, they get status, they've learned how to lead. And of course, the other thing we're doing is teaching a lot of these women technical skills. And the work we've been doing on GIS to get more women into geographic information systems has been absolutely fantastic. We all know that women can be meticulous in their attention to detail. That makes them both excellent deminers working in the field, but it also makes them excellent technicians working on a whole range of specialist high-end tasks back in the headquarters.
That's a perfect segue. We've talked a lot about the nature of your work, but let's take a deeper dive into the role of location analytics or spatial analytics in your work. First, of course, mapping technology helps find the mines and the munitions, which must be particularly helpful in places where information isn't totally digitized like Afghanistan. But can you expand on that a little more?
Yeah, when we began, this was an exercise in hand-drawing maps. And in fact, we're still hand-drawing maps in certain parts of the world. And so the problem is with hand-drawn maps is that they're not digital, they can't be stored on a central database. So information gets lost, it gets distorted, you get contradictory information, you have surveys that are done many years ago, nobody knows whether it's still valid or not. And what the digital age has brought us is the capacity to centralize information at a national level, making sure that the host nation is the people really in charge of it, and to get a far better understanding of the scale of the problem. You can waste literally tens of millions more if you're using bad data. So we want to move off hand-drawn, old-fashioned data and move to that digital platform. What this revolution has also brought is exquisite high resolution imagery. And whilst I said at the beginning, a lot of landmines are buried, even if they are buried, they leave a signature, which LIDAR and magnetic resonance and other methods, other technologies can use to identify where the mine is buried. And particularly at dawn and dusk, when there's a heat differential between the mine itself and the surrounding soil. But a lot of landmines in Ukraine have been surface laid because the Russians laid them in a hurry. And so by using this mass of data, satellite imagery, drone imagery, we can work out very exactly where the contamination is. Of course, there is the risk of being just deluged in too much visual data that we can't process. So we've got to find new ways of processing it rapidly. The next step, which is really exciting, is that teaching machines, machine learning, how to learn how to identify where the mines are, what types of mines they are. You get this particular anti-tank mine used in Ukraine, and there are 7 variants of that one mine, and they each have slightly different methodologies needed to clear them. So by getting to that next stage of machine learning and the use of artificial intelligence, we can speed up the process. And that's my final point, I think, which is that the process of mine clearance is painstakingly slow. And from conflicts that began in Ukraine in 1979, or even earlier in some conflicts from the 1960s, we're still having to do the clearance now. That's not what the Ukrainians want. They want to get their country free of mines far quicker than that. And it's not going to happen without the use of machine learning and artificial intelligence.
James, you talked about the information created with this centralization and this geographic information systems, and the representative data is helping when the land is back to being habitable and being handed back to the local people for development. How is that data then leveraged and used to drive change?
What's important is that we understand the impact of our work, and confidence is a big part of that. Communities may be mistrustful about whether the land is really safe. And we are seeing quite a lot of instances in Ukraine at the moment where people are told the land has been cleared, but they don't believe it. So we've got to really understand the impact of what we're doing, studying human behaviors. And again, big data can help us hugely in that process, not only for us to understand what humans are doing, but actually to educate humans by showing them the data to show that the land really is clear. The reality is that this is saving human life. It is stopping people being killed and wounded, often children. And it is then allowing them to reoccupy land that was contaminated, often in very dense ways, to get back on that very valuable land and to lead a life in safety. I'm often struck by a picture from our operation in Zimbabwe. And it's a picture of a school and a teacher asking some children a question. And the children, some of them have got their hands up. In fact, most of them have got their hands up. And it looks like just a normal question. What's 3 + 3 or what's the capital of Zimbabwe? Actually, he's asking them, how many of you walked to school today through a minefield? And our job is to ensure that there are no mines left and that those children can walk to school in safety. And we are doing that very rapidly in Zimbabwe. And we can show those local people through the imagery that we have that it genuinely is safe to do so.
So needless to say, this is very important work globally. What do you wish people better understood about this work and the situation?
I think a number of things. The first thing I'd say is that the clearance of landmines is part of the broader problem of conflict. As I said at the beginning, conflict is on the rise again, and in very alarming ways. We're now witnessing war across West Africa. We're seeing conflict in the South Caucasus. Obviously, in Ukraine, we're seeing rising tension in the West Balkans, which is still contaminated by landmines. People pay no attention at all to a country like Myanmar, which is one of the most mine-affected countries in the world. There are stagnant conflicts that are set in ASPEC and are not active, but where huge numbers of landmines are present. I would take, for example, the Iraq-Iran border and the Korean border between North and South Korea. So the world has far more landmines than anybody could possibly want. and we have a lot more work to do to clear them. But HALO is more than just about landmines. We're also tackling small arms, and we're tackling bombs and artillery systems. And so we need help to address that. And HALO intends to be at the center of taking action on conflict.
James, it's clear these conflicts have a very long tail, and the impacts aren't just in the period of discrete conflicts. Thank you for sharing that.
Thank you, John.
Thanks for listening to the ESRI and the Science of War podcast. And thanks to James Cowan of the HALO Trust. You'll find more stories about the extraordinary work done by other extraordinary people in David Yarnold's book, The Geography of Hope, Real Life Stories of Optimists Mapping a Better World.